Welcome to the AI Policy Podcast, a podcast by the Wadhwani Center for AI and Advanced Technologies at CSIS. I'm Gregory C. Allen.
And I'm Andrew Schwartz.
Join us as we dive into the world of AI policy, where we'll discuss the implications of this transformative technology for national security, geopolitics, and global governance. Welcome back to the AI Policy Podcast. I'm Gregory C. Allen, your host. Andrew Schwartz is out sick today. Arguably, I should be out sick today too, but here I am, and I'm with my co-host, Associate Director of the Wadhwani Center, Brielle Hill. Brielle, thanks for coming.
Happy to be back.
So what are we talking about today?
Well, today we're really cutting across all three pillars of the Wadhwani Center here at CSIS: geopolitics, governance, and national security. We're going to start internationally talking about Microsoft's investment in G42, then move over to the allegations of the Israeli military's use of an AI tool called Lavender. And then we're going to wrap up with some more big tech news domestically with Meta's new watermarking policy.
Sounds great.
Big episode. So let's just start by jumping into Microsoft and G42. On Tuesday, Microsoft announced it would make a $1.5 billion, with a B, investment in G42, which is an artificial intelligence group based in the United Arab Emirates. G42, for those who may not know, is UAE's largest AI group and has previous ties to China. Notably, their technology infrastructure was built in partnership with Huawei and other Chinese companies, and they were forced to divest from ByteDance. Greg, you were quoted in the New York Times earlier this week. You said basically this is amongst the most advanced technology that the U.S. possesses, and there should be very strategic rationale for offshoring it anywhere. Being that this is the AI Policy Podcast, why does the policy community need to care about this deal?
There's so many different geopolitical threads that are wound up in this one decision by Microsoft and by the United States Department of Commerce related to this deal to invest in G42. So to begin, G42 is pretty unambiguously the leading AI research and development firm in the United Arab Emirates. Their basic business model is to make the most advanced stuff for the UAE and Arab market. That's the idea. So it's the sort of local champion in AI of the UAE. Now, one thing that you think of when you think of the United Arab Emirates is an awful lot of money. This is a very oil-rich state, and like a lot of other Gulf nations, they are thinking about how to diversify their economy away from oil, and technology is one of these attractive options. So G42 is a company born in this sort of context as the UAE is seeking to diversify away from oil as a sort of exclusive source of revenue. And that leads them to the other two big AI powers in the world, China and the United States.
So in January, the House Select Committee on the CCP wrote a letter urging Commerce to look into whether G42 should be put under trade restrictions for its ties to China. Why are there some concerns about this deal altogether?
So the national security community has been looking into G42 as a company for a long time, partly for the reason that you described at the beginning. It has this sort of long-standing relationship with Huawei. Its founder was born in China, although is now a citizen of the UAE, and the company has ties to Chinese technology firms. Now, G42, for its part, has been saying for a long time that they are willing, and now at this point planning, to divest themselves of all their ties with China. So in December of last year, G42's chief executive said in the Financial Times, quote, "For better or worse, as a commercial company, we are in a position where we have to make a choice. We cannot work with both sides. We can't." And he's referring to the United States and China. So at that point last year, G42 had relationships with US companies. They had relationships with Chinese companies. And what they're saying is that this deal and a prior deal that they had with OpenAI from October 2023 was attractive enough, and the Commerce Department export controls were frightening enough that they were willing to break all their ties with China, or at least the ones that were of greatest concern to the Commerce Department and the U.S. national security community. And then Microsoft claims that on top of everything else, they have some restrictions built into this deal related to cybersecurity, related to customer monitoring, that sort of is intended to give the national security community what it needs to view this as a win, you know, not to view this as a foolish transfer of U.S. technology that might wind up later in the hands of China.
So for our policy friends, this is, again, a national security story.
That's right. And the reason why I said this is indicative of a broader strategic move is China has been arguing publicly in its diplomacy, I guess both publicly and privately, I should say, that the chip export controls that the Biden administration levied originally in October of 2022 were designed to hamper its rise in AI. But what China has also been saying to the rest of the world is, look, America's holding us back, but really they're going to end up holding you back too. And this deal gives the United States a little bit of ammunition and saying, like, no, we're actually willing to support the rise of AI in the rest of the world. But that does come with conditions. And the conditions is you cannot be a partner of companies who are supporting the Chinese military and intelligence community. So that's the argument in favor of this deal. I do want to honestly state some of the unknowns here, because what is available in the public at this point is not the whole context around the story. One question that I had in looking at this is, right now this is structured as a deal between Microsoft and G42. The question is, what does it signal for the broader UAE as a country part of a story? China is among the largest trading partners of the UAE. It might actually be the largest trading partner of the UAE. And plenty of other technology companies within China have not necessarily promised to divest themselves of Chinese technology. So the question is, let's say you agree that this deal does what Microsoft says it does, which is take the top AI company in the UAE and pull it into the US camp when it comes to AI technology away from China. That would definitely be a win. But the question is there going to be other UAE firms, perhaps firms that will harvest G42 employees and knowledge, who are then going to be a source of technology transfer or knowledge transfer to China? So my question is, while it does seem that the Commerce Department was evaluating these in strategic terms, is the deal between companies or is it between countries? And what kind of safeguards exist at the country stage? That's questions that I haven't seen answered, at least not yet in public.
So this sounds like it's been an ongoing thing. This didn't happen overnight. What are the origins of this entire agreement and the Biden administration's involvement?
Well, if you believe the reporting in the New York Times in November 2023, according to the New York Times, the intelligence community provided classified assessments to policymakers expressing concerns over the connection between G42 and China, right? This is after that October agreement announced between OpenAI and G42. And later, Secretary of Commerce Gina Raimondo, as we mentioned earlier, traveled twice to the UAE, where this deal was discussed, and specifically security arrangements for this agreement and related partnerships. G42 is obviously having discussions with the Commerce Department's Bureau of Industry and Security. They're the ones who oversee those chip export controls. And I think Microsoft President Brad Smith said it well when he said, quote, "The U.S. is quite naturally concerned that the most important technology is guarded by a trusted U.S. company." And I think that is Microsoft, to a certain extent, sort of stating explicitly that they believe that this deal advances U.S. national security interests and that that is part of the justification. And they're very much framing themselves as a U.S. company, which, when you think about it, you know, 10, 15 years ago, it was very common for leading technology giants to frame themselves mostly as a global company. And now, in the wake of this geopolitical competition, companies like Microsoft are emphasizing the U.S. nature of their technology.
So it sounds like we're going to be watching this story unfold as a potential precedent-setting framework for how the U.S. can continue to advance AI abroad while continuing to push our national security concerns.
Yeah, this is really exhibit A in the geopolitics of AI and what I think we might see playing out again and again in the coming years.
Great. So staying in international AI, let's shift over to some news in the military applications of AI. Mm-hmm. In the first week of April, Israeli publications 972 Magazine and Local Call published a report drawing on testimony regarding Israel's target generation process during the ongoing conflict with Hamas. The report, which has since been picked up by, you know, Washington Post, Financial Times, the New York Times, introduces Lavender, an AI tool allegedly used by the Israeli military and the role it has played in the conflict. The IDF has denied these allegations, and the U.S. said it's looking into it. But in order to talk about the policy implications of these types of AI military tools, I think we need to break down the technology a little bit. So could you give me an overview of what we know about this tool so far?
Sure. And I should say that while I used to serve in the Department of Defense in an AI policy and strategy role, I had no specific prior knowledge of this system, and I left the Department of Defense 2 years ago, and I'm definitely not going to share any classified information on this podcast. So the discussion that we have is going to be based on this report and assessing, you know, if this report is true, which obviously, as you said, the IDF denies this report, but the journalists are claiming that they had interviews with six Israeli intelligence officers who were personally involved with using this AI system. So let's just talk about, you know, if the, what these claims are and what it would mean if they were necessarily true. So this system is expressing a prediction of how likely it is that somebody who lives in Gaza is in fact a Hamas militant. And according to the reporting in the article, this is actually using machine learning algorithms. So they have a set of data about these people, and that can include hundreds of thousands of different kinds of features. And those features might, you know, include things about being in a WhatsApp group with a known militant, or changing cell phones every few months, and changing addresses frequently, according, you know, to the reporting in the article. And then based on taking all of that data, analyzing it, it then creates a prediction about future folks. So you have the sort of set of folks you know are in Hamas, and then you generate this program for analyzing if somebody is likely to be in Hamas. And this is tied to targeting decisions, the actual use of force in weapons. There's a few things that I think are interesting in this piece. One is how reliable this system actually is. According to the reporting, they being the Israeli Defense Forces, think that the system has about a 90% accuracy. We have no independent way of verifying whether or not that actually is the number here. The second thing is the use of automation and the behaviors exhibited by military forces in the presence of a system that is claiming to be AI, claiming to be incredibly accurate. So separate for a second whether or not the system actually is accurate. There is this interesting behavior of the Israeli Defense Forces, and one of the intelligence operatives interviewed for the article states that they just sort of came to delegate the decision to the machine, and that was a source of emotional calm. And that's a really interesting claim here, because it basically says that the sort of human factor of fighting in a war and the sort of emotional weight of fighting in a war, they were able to distance themselves by delegating that decision to the AI, and that made the use of force a little bit easier. Now, there's other parts of war fighting where people have already talked about that phenomenon. Folks who drop bombs in planes say that it's easier to do that and to distance yourself from the action than to fire bullets from somebody you're looking at through a target scope. But this is sort of an additional layer of distancing and emotional breakage from what we've seen in prior wars, prior technologies.
So having never been a part of the DoD myself, I can only assume that others use targeting systems and they, you know, have started to integrate more AI technology into their militaries. How is Lavender similar to other AI-enabled targeting platforms we see used by other major military powers?
Well, the systems that the U.S. military has been publicly talking about in its use of AI are things like Project Maven or analyzing satellite imagery. And in there, the human review process is still pretty significant. To just give you one example, and it's easier to talk about some of the stuff that's in commercial usage. So Maxar, which is a commercial satellite reconnaissance firm, they take pictures from satellites and then sell them to people. They use AI to pre-process the imagery and then send it to human analysts saying, we think this image is most likely to be of interest to you, human analyst. So it's still a recommendation engine type of process, but rather than be a recommendation engine that gives you the answer, bomb this, it is a recommendation engine telling you what pictures to look at first as the analyst to sort of make the best use of your human analytical time. This is directly tied to targeting decisions, and according to the reporting, at least, which the IDF denies, really led people to trust that system and make decisions quite quickly based on its recommendation.
So from a policy position, the question really is about the level of oversight involved with the use of these technologies.
Well, there's a lot of questions that are raised in policy here. One of the things that I always said when I was in the Department of Defense regarding the ethical use of military AI is that, of course, it is possible to envision a scenario in which military AI technology is used unethically, but it's also very easy to envision a scenario in which a person uses their fists unethically. So the question is not, you know, can it be used unethically? The question is, are there ways to use it ethically? Are there ways to put safeguards in place that would make it extremely likely that it was going to be used ethically? But the reporting in this story that I think is so interesting is how, again, according to the claims, which are not confirmed, it led to actually less checking. And all, part of that relates to the sort of the pressure of the conflict as it was engaged and the demands from political leadership. But it is an interesting example, if true, about those safeguards being difficult to actually put in place, at least in this context. What I would say is, you know, the United States military in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan really got to a place where lawyers were really heavily involved in almost every decision over the use of force, especially in airstrikes. And that was a really intense review process that was, you know, a conscious decision of how we chose to execute policy. But the laws of war, and especially international humanitarian law when it comes to war, deal with these principles for what could possibly justify the use of military force. Things like proportionality, making an effort to distinguish between military targets and civilian targets. And those issues are raised in this story, but you can imagine them being raised on either side of the argument. What do I mean by that? The type of bombing that was done in World War II was incredibly imprecise. You know, number one, there was actual just bombing of cities on a massive scale. But even when there was efforts to use precision bombing to target, for example, Nazi ball bearing factories, the precision targeting wasn't very precise. You know, the bombs missed all the time. Here, you could argue that, and I'm sure the critics of Israel will argue this, that according to the reporting, Israel was focusing on bombing Hamas militants when they were in their homes because they thought that was, one, an easier strike to pull off, and two, minimized certain types of collateral damage. The other side would criticize the Israeli military for saying you bombed these people in their homes when their families might also be there with them. So you have not made, you know, an effective enough decision on distinguishing between military and civilian participants. And that's true even if Lavender is incredibly accurate, as the IDF is claiming. So all of these debates continue to rage with or without the use of AI. And I think most of the core issues are not really about the use of AI, but there are some interesting things, like I said, about, you know, the human willingness to use force that do come out in this story that are a bit unique about AI.
So when I hear AI military capabilities, I'm also thinking autonomous weaponry.
Yeah, of course.
Is this autonomous weaponry? It doesn't sound like it is from what you're saying.
It's actually not. At least as described in the article, this system would not meet the definition of an autonomous weapon. And why that's true is how it is constructed. So the Department of Defense definition of an autonomous weapons system, which is defined in Department of Defense Directive 3000.09, that says that an autonomous weapon is one that can, once activated, select and engage targets without further intervention from a human operator. What's interesting is Israel does have autonomous weapons. The Harpy drone is like the classic example of something that is definitely an autonomous weapon. But what I want to emphasize is that the Lavender system, as described, is actually a human-in-the-loop system. There is a human operator that is saying this target is approved. They are pushing the button. And the question that is sort of raised is what actually constitutes adequate human review in an era of AI in order to meet obligations under international humanitarian law, under the law of war. So to give you an example, you know, the United States also has autonomous weapons systems, but our autonomous weapon systems tend to be exclusively defensive and anti-materiel, like planes, missiles, tanks, and not anti-personnel, like infantry, soldiers, or for targeted assassinations. The U.S. autonomous weapons, the problem to be solved is a little bit easier computationally. Something that is burning at 4,000 degrees hot and flying at 3 times the speed of sound, the odds that that's a military system are pretty high, right? But something that is a person walking into a home, that is a much more difficult thing to assess whether or not that is a legitimate military target. And what's interesting here is that if this reporting is true, right, that's an extension of the use of AI, not in an autonomous mode, but in a way where a human was in the loop, but you would potentially raise the question about whether or not that human in the loop action actually provided meaningful safeguards or met obligations under international humanitarian law. I should say that right now, the Department of Defense and 50 other countries are actually engaged in working groups to come up with codes of conduct related to autonomy and weapon systems, AI and weapon systems, and sort of write the playbook for what would actually constitute substantive action with regard to these systems to meet commitments such as those commitments under international humanitarian law and the law of war.
So we're going to be watching this for the development of frameworks to govern AI military technology. But we also have been talking about some of this over the past couple of months anyways. A couple of our events touch on this. Greg, do you want to talk about some of our past events?
Yeah, we've had 2 events just in the past month that have been really good about military AI. One was we were talking with Matt Turek, who's the deputy director of the I2O office in DARPA. So this is the, you know, advanced military research and development arm of the United States military. And Matt Turek leads a lot of the most interesting work on AI applications in defense. So if you're interested about, you know, cutting edge research that the military is doing on these topics, I recommend the conversation with Matt Turek. And then another conversation that we had was with 2 folks from the Office of the Chief Digital and Artificial Intelligence Officer in the Department of Defense. And they're talking about the types of technologies that are used to accelerate adoption of AI throughout the Department of Defense, and also some of the exercises that are being used to test these technologies between the United States military and its allies and partners.
In a very natural transition, I want to talk about big tech again. Something we've been following on this podcast is watermarking AI-generated content. And as the 2024 elections heat up in the U.S., concerns about deepfakes are becoming more and more prevalent. On October 5th, Meta announced it will apply labels to AI-generated content in image, video, and audio formats. These changes were an update to their ongoing policy changes after a heavily altered video of President Biden was published in 2023 and was not removed as it did not meet standards for their removal. This year, an oversight board determined that the existing policy from 2022 was, quote, incoherent and, quote, confusing, and it did not reflect the immense technological advancements of AI and accessibility to AI, kicking off this series of recent policy updates. So what are the major barriers to successfully implementing watermarking measures on different types of media, and how can these measures be easily circumvented?
Gosh, well, actually, there is a tie-in between this and what we were just talking about, because one of the things that Dr. Matt Turek of DARPA is working on is advanced deepfake detection technology, which the United States Department of Defense assesses it's in its interest to develop that field. So some of the work that Meta is doing here is actually downstream of work that DARPA has been doing for, I think, the past 5 years or so. A lot of the researchers in this area at universities are funded by DARPA. The basic story here is that Meta is deciding that deepfake technology is now so high quality and so universally available that part of its integrity responsibilities to its customers, to the global information ecosystem, is making it clear what is and what is not AI-generated imagery. I'm all for it. I think this is really important because we've moved from an era in which just the average person's eyes and ears can tell what is synthetically generated media, what is computer generated media, and what is not, to now, even if you spend all day, every day looking at this stuff, it is really easy to be fooled, especially by high quality forgeries. So Meta has basically said, we are going to take our technological toolbox for detecting AI generated media, and we are going to automatically apply that to content that comes in. Now, some of these tools, such as watermarking, involve modifying the files in a way that is designed to signal to the users, whether with metadata or with some type of data that is actually embedded in the image or video or audio file itself. The metadata stuff is useful, but it's also tough because if you, for example, take a screenshot of an AI-generated photo, well, that screenshot doesn't have any of the metadata tags that were associated with that original image file. So you actually do need some type of software system that is scanning the image itself if you want this to work at scale. For a company like Facebook, that's a bit of a challenge because it's kind of computationally intensive to run all these algorithms on every image, every video, every audio file that's coming in to constantly be scanning for whether or not it's AI generated. But I think to its credit, Meta has decided that this is part of their integrity responsibilities.
It seems interesting to me that Meta appears to be leading the charge on this. Is that true? Are other companies following suit, or are they already implementing some of this themselves?
I think every AI company at this point, at least all the major big ones in the United States, such as Google, Microsoft, Meta, and OpenAI, have all described some kind of effort related to watermarking and deepfake detection. What's a little bit different about Meta in this case is that they are also the content distributor. Right? They are not just developing AI tools, they are also distributing all of this media through their social media platforms. That gives them a different kind of an opportunity because the image might be made using anyone's AI image generation or video generation software, maybe even open source, you know, types of video and image generation software. But Meta is saying that not just media that's created with its tools, but any media that finds its way to its platforms is going to be scanned for deepfakes. And I think that's quite timely with the upcoming United States election.
I've heard watermarking thrown around as sort of this fix that everybody comes up with as the way to beat AI and impacting our elections. Do you think that this is just the first step? Is this the right step? Where should we go from here?
I think watermarking at this point is probably going to have to be required by law, because I think the big tech platforms have sort of already started heading in this direction. They're interested in watermarking for their own various reasons, whether those are self-interested financial reasons or whether those are just, you know, public service types of motivations. The question is that right now, these image generation tools are expensive and complicated to create, and that's why big companies are the primary distributors of them. But we've seen in the past with companies like Stability AI that creating one of these image generation software systems is actually not all that expensive. We're talking, you know, $10 million, $20 million. So not nothing, but not, you know, incredible money. So I think the number of firms that can create these types of systems or the open source projects that can create these kinds of systems are going to be pretty distributed. And then the question is, what about these small actors who might decide to skimp on these types of safeguards like watermarking? What do we do about those folks? And so I'm not especially worried about the big tech companies. They seem to be headed in this direction. But I do think, and I hear constantly in my conversations on Capitol Hill or with the executive branch agencies, and even among the big tech companies, about the likelihood of making this a regulated requirement.
Well, three huge topics, three crazy advancements in AI this week. We're going to be watching at the Wadhwani Center for AI and Advanced Technologies. Thanks for having me back on this episode.
Thanks for coming back.
I'm always thrilled to be a part of it. Our listeners, please drop us a line at AIPolicyPodcast@CSIS.org in case you have any thoughts, topics you'd like for us to touch on or insights that we should look into. And of course, check out our show notes for those events that Greg talked about and go to CSIS.org to sign up for our newsletter. Mm-hmm.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode of the AI Policy Podcast. Be sure to subscribe on your favorite podcast platform so you never miss an episode. And don't forget to visit our website, csis.org, for show notes and our research reports. This podcast was produced by David Lotfi, Isaac Goldston, Isabel Burns, and Sadie McCullough. See you next time.